This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
After 40 years in the Angelina County Jail in Lufkin, Texas, 76-year-old Robert Carroll Coney, along with his common-law wife, were freed after a judge learned his confession to a 1962 robbery was obtained by crushing Coney's fingers between cell bars. And then there's Earl Washington Jr., 9 days before he was scheduled to die. After 18 years in prison, a DNA test proved mentally retarded Earl Washington Jr. had not committed murder after all. Michael Graham had spent half of his adult life, 14 years on a Louisiana death row, for a 1987 murder. The prosecution withheld evidence of Graham's innocence, so in March 2000, Michael was released with a $10 check from the state, plus an overcoat 5 sizes too large. There is endless real evidence to show that in 38 states, our courts have unflinchingly prescribed death for people under age 18, mentally retarded, suffering some degree of psychosis, and often convicted on false testimony, represented by drunk or sleeping, underpaid, court-appointed public defenders. Barry Scheck, 27 years a law professor, teaching at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law, co-founder of the nonprofit legal clinic, The Innocence Project, a pioneer in the arena of the forensic use of DNA, and commissioner on New York's Forensic Science Review Board, tells the story of one of his favorite clients, Eddie Joe Lloyd. A detective, under pressure to solve a particular murder, fixed his sights on Eddie Joe, mentally troubled and institutionalized at the time. The detective gave Eddie many details of the crime and convinced him that if he, Eddie, confessed to the crime, it might help smoke out the real killer. Thanks to the Innocence Project, Eddie Joe Lloyd is not serving time for a crime he did not commit. And there is a civil case pending regarding his confession. Also, owing to the ongoing work of the Innocence Project, about a year ago, the Advancing Justice Through DNA Technology Act was passed in the U.S. Congress with a 357-67 vote. The legislation grants an inmate convicted of a federal crime the right to ask for a DNA test to support a claim of innocence. But many stand accused in cases where DNA testing is not a factor. Here is Barry Scheck.
Never had so many innocent people proven innocent after conviction ever in this period of time. It's a landmark event. But the key thing to learn is, why did it happen? What are the causes of wrongful convictions, and how can we prevent them from happening again? Because you have to realize it's only about 20% of serious felony cases that have any biological evidence where you can do a DNA test. Yeah. What about the robbery, the murder, the burglary, the serious crime where there's an eyewitness or there's a confession, or there's some other kind of laboratory work by a crime lab, or there is ineffective assistance of counsel or misconduct by police or prosecutors? All these are the causes of wrongful convictions. But in most cases, 80% of the cases, there's no DNA testing that can check the work and prove if an injustice has been done. So the most important thing to do is look at these cases where innocent people have been convicted, nobody doubts it, and try to learn the lessons to prevent it from happening again. So we now at the Innocence Project are moving forward very aggressively in policy reform. There are ways to do identification procedures that will cut down on the number of wrong identifications without cutting down on the number of right identifications. And to run photo arrays and lineups in this fashion and other reforms in terms of eyewitness procedures is critical, because at the beginning of a case, you want to make sure that the eyewitness is not mistakenly identifying the wrong person while the real person is out there committing more crimes, particularly if it's a serial rapist or a serial murderer. So there are ways to do this. And we are working cooperatively with police departments and prosecutors to bring it about. We're going back into the courts to litigate for eyewitness reform. Take false confessions, a major cause of the conviction of the innocent, and been exposed in many of our DNA exonerations. What about videotaping interrogations at precincts on serious cases? This is a reform that we've taken up. The legislature passed it in Illinois. We've got this reform now in Miami, Broward County, Florida, where there'd been a number of wrongful convictions based on false confessions. San Diego, California, Maine just passed a statute. It makes perfect sense. Judges want it. The New Jersey Supreme Court indicated to the Attorney General's office they want the state of New Jersey to do it. Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts is indicating it. So we are working with people in our Innocence Network and other pro-law enforcement criminal justice reform groups to try to get videotaping of interrogations. It protects police against false accusations that they coerced confessions. It creates a record to make sure that police are not inadvertently feeding information to a suspect that only the perpetrator could know. It presents a good record for courts to review whether the interrogation was done correctly and whether it's sound evidence, and it's the best evidence for juries. So it's an overall improvement in the system. Crime labs are an enormous problem in this country. What our post-conviction DNA exonerations show is that so many crime labs, so many of them unaccredited, with inadequate funding and incompetent personnel, have led to many, many wrongful convictions. Yesterday, I was in Cleveland, Ohio, and this case probably illustrates everything. A client of ours, Michael Green. 16 years ago, Michael Green was convicted of a rape of a cancer patient at the Cleveland Clinic Hotel. It's a place where patients for the Cleveland Clinic, a world-class medical institution, would stay. He had formerly been an employee there. He was mistakenly identified with some bad photo procedures. There was a statement made by a police officer that questioned Michael that, of course, was not, you know, videotaped or recorded. And also, at his trial, there was serology testimony from semen found on a vaginal swab and a hair. That a serologist hair expert for the Cleveland Police Department clinic said came from Michael Green. He gave a statistic that was wrong about the serology, about the ABO typing, and perhaps worst of all, he said that the hair that was found in the rape kit, a pubic hair, matched Michael Green, and there was a statistic of something like 1 in 40,000. Only 1 in 40,000 people would have that hair pattern, which is ridiculous because there's no such thing as statistics in hairs. We then got DNA testing from Michael. It proved him innocent. The prosecutor in Cleveland let him go, agreed he was innocent. Then the Cleveland Plain Dealer did an article a year after his release called The Burden of Innocence. And the real perpetrator read the article and decided to come forward with a priest saying, I can't take it anymore. It's terrible the way Michael has suffered. I can't live with my conscience. I really committed the crime. A man named Rodney Rines came forward and said, 14 years later, that he had committed the crime. And then at the time of the sentencing for Rodney Rines, who pled guilty, who showed up? Michael Green. And he said, give this man the minimum. I'm thankful that he finally came forward and admitted his crime, and it lifts a cloud over me, and we should forgive. Extraordinary testament to his decency, humanity, and good character. So then a civil suit was filed. And in the course of a civil suit seeking damages from Michael Green for his wrongful conviction, we discovered that Joseph Sirowick, the hair analyst for the Cleveland Police Department, we got some of his prior cases. And he starts looking at the prior cases, and we get his underlying notes, and the hairs don't match. But he gave reports and testified in courts that the hair did match. We say, how could you do this? And he goes, well, the defense attorney is never going to see my underlying notes. And this was such egregious testimony that the city of Cleveland, its law director and its mayor, stepped forward and they said, you know what? We're going to settle this case. We're going to give Mr. Green a lot less money, everybody recognizes, and he might have gotten from a jury $1.6 million over 8 years. But the most important thing is that the city of Cleveland said that they were going to conduct what we're calling the Michael Green forensic audit. They're going to look at 16 years worth of hair and serology work of Joseph Sirowick and do a random audit of some others in the lab. We know he testified at least 100 times. They're going to go through those cases to see if there are any discrepancies, and then if there are problems, notify the court so that we can correct the injustices. So yesterday I was with the mayor of the city of Cleveland, the law director, and Michael Green when this was announced. And the mayor said, you know, he could have gotten a lot more money, but he wanted to make sure that other people who were innocent would be freed from prison and we would correct the mistakes. And frankly, it was a benefit to the entire city because it will help improve the crime lab. Remember, every time an innocent person is convicted, sentenced, or God forbid executed, the real perpetrator is out there committing more crimes. So that is a signal success and quite a story.
Absolutely. Having said that, H.R. 3214 did pass last year. Where does it stand in the Senate right now?
Well, the Innocence Protection Act has two parts to it. One is it would require DNA testing in every state in the country if it could raise a reasonable probability somebody was wrongfully convicted or sentenced. Another part of it provides additional funding for lawyers representing clients in death penalty cases. And it is bottled up in the Senate, even though there was bipartisan support for this for the last 3 or 4 years.
The vote last year was something like 257 to 67. Can you tell me what the 67 naysayers are thinking?
I really don't know. Remember, the bill is tied to money to assist lawyers representing defendants in capital cases. So there's some resistance on that front, which doesn't make any sense because we see so many wrongful convictions in capital cases, greatly disproportionate to the percentage of the population. 0.25% of people in American prisons are on death row, yet 22% of the exonerations by both DNA and non-DNA evidence since 1989 are in death penalty cases, and people that were on death row that turned out to be innocent. So is it because we pay more attention to those cases? And the implication is if you look at the run-of-the-mill felony for which people get 50, 70 years in jail, if we paid more attention, we'd find more innocence. Or is it in death penalty cases, there's a greater chance of error because there's such heinous crimes that it inflames the community and people are not as sensible as they might be in the trial of the case? Or is it both? Any way you look at it, it doesn't speak well for the reliability of this system that results in so many executions and so many people on death row in America. You know, the American Bar Association has been on record now for many years, whether you're for or against the death penalty in principle. What our innocence cases have shown is that you have to have a doubt as to whether we're reliably putting people on death row or even executing them. Many of them are innocent. That's just a fact. And that race of the victim determines who gets death and who doesn't. The level of competency of counsel is woeful. And there's a accidents of geography in terms of who gets death and who doesn't in a particular state. So the real question, though, in America is the system that we have now being fairly administered? And the answer is simply no. The system doesn't work. So there should certainly be a moratorium on executions in America.
Do you think it's time for a moratorium or even an end to the death penalty? Log on to the Voices of Our World webpage, www.maryknoll.org/voices. There's a spot there for your feedback. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Barry Scheck and Sister Helen Prejean are just two of the voices of our world. Voices of Our World is a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. Our producers are Kathy Golden and Eleanor Ostrinsky, and our executive producer is Larry Rich. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. You heard music today by The Frames and tenor Art Jones. You'll find more information on today's guests and topics on our program's website, www.maryknoll.org/voices. And if you'd like to find out more about Mary Knoll or to subscribe to Mary Knoll Magazine in English or Spanish, just call 1-877-MARY-KNOLL. If you have questions or comments about this show, again, just call 1-877-MARY-KNOLL. 877-MARY-KNOLL. If you missed a portion of this program, you can catch us on Mary Knoll's website, www.maryknoll.org/voices. And please join us next time for more Voices of Our World.